What's up, everyone?
All right. We got a full house in Antifada Studios today. We're joined by Jared Shanahan, a voice I'm sure you remember.
What's up, Antifada world?
And he's here with his massive masked cadre of Chicago rabble-rousers. They're part of a group called Lake Effect from the shores of Lake Michigan. And we're going to talk about practicing politics the right way.
So you figured it out?
Well, you're going to tell us. So this is a group that came to my attention from some writings about the DNC in Chicago this summer. And they've continued writing about organizing and, you know, reflections on American culture and politics. And so we're going to go into some of those articles. Who of this massive assemblage would like to introduce the group a little bit better than I just did it?
Hi. So we're Lake Effect Collective from, like Andy said, Lake Michigan. We're a group that does a lot of collective writing, thinking together, various topics. Talked about the DNC. We've been thinking a lot about deportations in Chicago, that sort of situation in the Midwest. We're sort of a group of different anarchists, communists, thinking together, working together. And I'm going to pass it to someone to talk about some of the writing.
Hi. So one of the things that our group places a pretty high premium on, I think, after just kind of being in this world for a bit, is having some kind of unity between like what we're thinking, how we're talking, like who is doing both of those things, and then also like what we're doing together, like practically. I think it's been a pretty consistent and common tendency, like in our part of the ultra left, to have like, you know, some groups that are like purely action, you know, action oriented, like groups that don't necessarily talk about the political theory stuff so much, but are like really engaged and like in the soup. And then like you've got the kind of abstruse, like highfalutin theoretical outlets that it's not clear what the activity is. And so at least in our group, we work very hard to, so we say, socialize the skills like a lot in the group. I don't know if anybody else wants to talk about that.
Yeah, totally. We actually came together while writing a report back on the University of Chicago Palestine encampment. A lot of, in my experience, a lot of collectives collectively author things that are actually just one person summarizing conversations that they've had with, you know, five or six others. But this was actually written by all 12 of the people that had come together after this encampment. It involved a lot of those conversations and a lot of like learning how to write and think in a fairly disciplined way. And at the end of it, we had, you know, written our various sections. Other people went over and edited other sections that they had ideas about. There were debates over the line edits and the content edits and all of that. And by the end of it, we actually felt like a much more politically coherent group than we'd been at the beginning. And so it's meant a lot to us to maintain that sort of, at least ability to do collective writing. These days, it's not all 12 of us typically, but we will, you know, settle on a topic that we'd like to write about and then send a message to everyone that says, hey, if you want to be a part of the Lake Effect Collective take on this or that question, you should hop in here and write something about it. Otherwise, you're going to have to hold your peace.
So just for a moment, let's get into a couple specifics so the audience knows a little bit about where you're coming from. What, like, who wants to summarize some of your takes on the Palestine encampments or DNC, just to give us a flavor of what you're all about?
The report back from the DNC dealt with a similar problem that we noticed at the Palestine encampment in a shorter format and with a little more kind of direct emphasis. And it was on the gap between fairly publicly legible, accessible, and honest, I would say, political formations, which in Chicago at least are dominated by these old nonprofits and recruitment-based organizations that march you up and down Michigan Avenue and then send everybody home at the end of the day, on one hand, and a kind of loose network of either previously anarchist affinity groups or little direct action crews that had come out of the Palestine movement and that really, really struggled and I believe continue to struggle to achieve any sort of like either unified political content between all of them and what they're doing, where they're focusing themselves, or like a strategic vision of how their activities fit into to realizing some sort of revolutionary goal. And
the title of the piece was "Seattle is Never Coming Back," right? So what's the reference to Seattle there?
Well, to be honest, Seattle, the Battle of Seattle occurred when I believe most of us had not been born. So if anybody wants to read that, most of us, sorry, Jared. Right. So if anybody a little older than us wants to hop in and tell us that we're full of shit, that's okay. But our sense is that involved a form of mass street mobilization that was fairly tactically unified, at least among the kind of radicals, had some sort of political content, had like fairly socialized and extreme tactics, and that the convergence around the DNC that involved a similar sort of like geographic concentration of people from all over the country with similarly sort of spectacular goals was maybe not imitating, but at least rhyming with what had happened back then. And we tried in that piece to highlight what was the same, the sort of like disaggregation of our forces, and maybe point at what was different, which I think we've highlighted a little better in our other pieces, just given it's been two decades.
Yeah, I mean, I think at least one thing also with the DNC last year is obviously in Chicago, as it was kind of like ramping up and people were kind of like thinking about like what to do to protest it, a lot of people were sort of calling upon the memory of like the 68 DNC convention in Chicago, and the way that went down with like tear gas like wafting into the delegate halls, and kind of this like massive like public like images of what had happened with like the protests there. And it was clearly like people were trying to evoke that, and like nothing like that happened at all. You know, it was like a very controlled protest situation.
There weren't any yippies fucking in the streets.
Okay, this might be heretical from an ultra standpoint, but my neighborhood in Chicago was covered in these posters that were saying, "Make the DNC great like it was in '68," and they literally
great, like there's going to be riots, and that was the great part.
Yeah,
of it.
Okay. And I mean, I have apologized for some really stupid movements and riots over the years, but if you actually read the story of '68, it was a terrible defeat. It was supposed to be a mass mobilization. Only a small percentage of the projected crowd actually showed up. The yippies who were leading it and other countercultural folks like Allen Ginsberg were not at all prepared for the level of militancy that they were talking about. And when push came to shove, they basically got their asses kicked up and down Grant Park for days in a way that really paralyzed the movement. And so I didn't see anything worth emulating in the model of '68, besides the fact that maybe there was a lot of television footage of people getting their asses beat by the CPD. But unfortunately, when those images were being broadcast in 1968, the vast majority of Americans approved of what the CPD was doing. And they used that as a kind of, that was a good example of how these hippies should be handled. And so I think it was a really ahistorical comparison to say, like, let's do that again. Let's do that massive fuck up again. But the good news is, if you set the bar low enough, you'll always hit it. And I feel like the folks who were organizing in this crew called Behind Enemy Lines, who organized this big demonstration, you know, I'd been watching this, you know, I'm not on Instagram or whatever, I don't follow this stuff, but like walking to the bus in the morning in my neighborhood, it was just like, we're behind enemy lines, we're hard as fuck and you aren't, you know. They had this thing that was just like, bruises are the new back to school fashion, get your ass kicked by the CPD. And it was just like, what kind of Christian masochism is this, you know? And so they called this big demonstration in front of the Israeli consulate. in a fucking, basically in a giant kettle. And they got what they wanted. They got like a bunch of people got their shit wrecked. Nobody could do anything to shut down even like the Israeli consulate, much less the DNC, because they were busy getting fucked up by like 500 CPD people. A bunch of comrades on our side got arrested, taking them out of circulation. And like, I don't want to be too hard on BEL, because I actually like really support bringing like the spirit of militancy and direct action into these kind of like NGO-ified movements. But they had this incredibly macho outlook that was based on a just completely inaccurate version of what the 68 DNC actually was. And in this kind of tragic twist, they ended up getting basically a smaller version of exactly what had happened, only it wasn't very great.
In some senses, this to me also reflects like a kind of emphasis on two different kinds of spectacle in the context of the DNC. So there was the large marches that were organized by these nonprofits that emphasized this idea of mass numbers that didn't in fact show up, and that wanted to project this number of numbers and instructed their marshals to keep the crowd in line, prevent anything from happening, and just sort of create this sort of image with no consequence and no effect on a march route that had no impact. And then you have this other side of things with the BEL action, which similarly like tried to frame as a win what was also in effect just like the spectacle of people getting beat up by the cops. And in neither of these actions is there any like strategy actually oriented towards Palestine, towards liberation, towards like concrete ways that these actions actually connect to like what was going on, but rather like it's this idea that through this spectacle you get this media attention that causes people to change their minds. And by that point in the summer, I think it was clear to many participants that something more than simply changing minds was the necessary route to take, but there was no real viable alternative offered, which sort of was one of the themes too in the DNC piece that we wrote, of like there's this very public above ground space that is just marching, and then there's this like with BEL posturing as this like much more militant space but not actually fulfilling that. And the question of what would it look like for different parts of the movement to actually work together and form some kind of composition that actually allows for strategic outcomes.
Let me jump in here with some of my memories of, you know, watching the DNC from afar, specifically on Hassan Piker's live stream, which was interesting because he was in the march. He was outside, and then he went from the march and walked inside to the DNC. He was really the one behind enemy lines, right? But, you know, of course, he was invited in. And I thought, okay, well, that's kind of smart of the Democrats to have this very popular leftist media creator give him a studio to watch the DNC and comment on it. And, you know, I think it was after a day and a half of streaming, somebody was watching that stream and saw, oh, this guy's talking about Palestine, and they kicked him out during the stream, midstream. They kicked him out. And I just think that was so emblematic of what the DNC really showed to who could have been a pretty sizable voting base for Harris, which was, no, we're not going to give any time to the Palestine issue. We're going to keep repeating the same bullshit pablum. We're not going to have trans speakers. We're not going to have Palestine speakers. We're not going to make even any give lip service to the left. This is not what this is about. And it was a very conscious choice on their part to move from there. Because remember, at this point, we still thought, okay, maybe Harris is going to at least appear to pivot to the left with the choice of walls. Maybe she's going to break from Biden, at least rhetorically. And she didn't do it. And I think in terms of the protest, the most iconic moment of the protest that I think for at least in the general cultural memory is the delegates marching out to people chanting about Palestine and them covering their ears and saying, I don't care. And I think that's, you know, that was really the message of DNC for a lot of us, which, you know, leads us to this current moment. Harris lost miserably. I think Palestine was definitely a major reason why she lost, among other issues of shanking the left. And so now we're in this really terrifying moment where we're simultaneously at the mercy of a Trump administration that's taking more and more power, like moving towards really a total state power in many ways. And there's a party that seems really disinterested in resisting him, even in the way that they were doing during his first administration. So maybe that can move us towards some of your more recent pieces.
Yeah. I think that we're in a situation on like what you're just saying, where like there's not even an offer of a poison pill. It's just like they don't want to work with us. Like in their mind, I think that, you know, our team threw them the election. But I'd maybe like to just, before we get into like the more current stuff, because I think it's informed a bit by some of these critiques that I think we didn't really cover just now, which is that like parts of these critiques about other organizations and like the lack of a viable alternative is also about our side and like the ultra left. And that like part of what I think that our group places a pretty high value on is like the ability to like look back on our own activities and see how they may or may not like point out of this morass. I mean, the U Chicago encampment piece is really quite long. I think it's worth reading if people haven't already, though. But the end of it sort of ends with this this problem that we're in, which is that like we ourselves got lost up in the kind of moment to moment sort of tactical, and not even tactical so much as technical, like problems of the day, such that we actually basically forgot, you know, how to place our kind of political vision. Yeah, that we were communists and anarchists in. And so like same for the DNC, like when we are talking about these like other groups and these like bad NGOs and the Democrats and like these other like more hardline like ML groups and so on, I think that these critiques also are partially towards like ourselves and our ability to affect the kind of change that we'd like to see. And it was after the DNC that I think we actually did kind of pass into a qualitatively different place as a group, where we've been able to like write some of the more recent stuff. So I just wanted to get that in so that it didn't just seem like we were like, you know, we had all the answers always.
Yeah. And I think maybe to temper the previous mention of behind enemy lines, we actually received a response to the mention that they got in Seattle is Never Coming Back, which we in turn responded to. I personally found that a really clarifying opportunity to get to the bottom of what like political content looks like for us as a group. And the way to maybe at least try to marry our understanding of race and class in the United States to the way we direct our very limited time and energy as radicals in the movement.
So yeah, jumping ahead a little bit to January of the current year, right before Trump comes in, on your resources page, you put out a document called Previous Tactics from the Fight Against ICE. And I think we all understood pretty clearly that the mass deportations promised by Trump was going to be one of the major first struggles we're going to encounter. So, what were some of the takeaways from this piece?
Yeah, I think one of the things that inspired this piece was that there was no, like, zine out there, like, in Chicago-focused or even, like, not, like, on immigration and, like, the actual tactics that, like, put that all in one concise place. Yeah, I think one major takeaway was how do we didn't want to, like, necessarily tell people what to do, But we wanted to like compile a list of different tactics from the previous Trump administration, which included like the Occupy ICE protests that happened, or like the airport protests that happened during the Muslim ban, and also like lay out how to do like ICE watch or like community patrolling, and actually like intervening, like examples. Past examples of people actually like intervening during ICE raids and like surrounding ICE vans and like freeing people that way. So we wanted to lay all those previous examples and have a space where people can read that stuff and be inspired to think creatively for this upcoming administration. And it lays it out pretty well.
Yeah, it's a pretty long zine. It's like 40 pages or something like that. And part of, I think like the creation of it also did come from like inspiration from the Palestine movement as well. While people were doing school occupations, and while they were doing those things, they were kind of calling back to previous occupations that had happened during Occupy, like in the 60s. And you saw a lot of people like trying to make these historical ties. And as it was clear after Trump had got elected that he would really be focusing on like deportation and immigration, wanting to like put this thing together. And also it just really felt like, I mean, I think for us that made it, it was also a learning experience, because I think there were a lot of things that we were like, oh, I like vaguely remember this happening, or I feel like I saw something on the news, but I don't remember the details, and like sources on things would be scattered around the internet, kind of amorphous. It was also clear there was a lot of things like Occupy ICE was in like 2018, I think, and there was like a big surge of anti-ICE like activity around that time, but it was clear that during the Biden administration, a lot of that had kind of died out, which is something we've also like tried to talk about, the ways in which, even though Trump has like moved billions of dollars to ICE and is really ramping up the deportation machine, the way in which the Democrats really like laid the stage for that to happen and enabled it. So I feel like the creation of this zine was kind of an attempt to like build some kind of like continuity.
I think also with like lessons from the Palestine movement was like, I think that 2023 to 2024 was really like an insightful moment for people who were like entering the movement and being politicized, just like seeing the like nonprofit industrial complex and the way it stops movements from progressing further, and really like serves to like make people feel like good about themselves, give themselves like a little pat in the back for like standing outside for a few hours, saying a few chants, and then going home, all while being hugged by police lines, essentially. And so I think what inspired this as well was like trying to get, like, in preparation for that, people still, because of like ICE typically targets like Black and brown folks, people are still like trying to get out of that mindset and still sometimes deferring to a lot of these like nonprofits who end up being like run by like Black and brown folks who serve like the local progressives in our city. But I think in Chicago more recently, people have started breaking out of that, and also through those lessons from the Palestine movement have kind of shifted to include like autonomous actions and thinking outside of that bubble when it comes to pushing the limits on this.
Yeah, I mean, my memories from the Occupy ICE stuff in New York is that there was this initiative taken on a grassroots level, largely by anarchists and other radicals, to, you know, more or less blockade and stay outside this ICE facility for as long as possible. And there is constant pressure from the NGOs that were directly supporting the detainees and people coming in and out for trials and hearings to not do that, to actually stop direct action, stop blocking vehicles, come and volunteer for those organizations as they move them from place to place and advocate for them. And this tension reached a point where there is a general assembly outside the ICE facility where they, after a long debate, people decided we are going to stay here and we're going to continue blocking the facility because we've shut it down. And as soon as that decision was made, someone from the NGO came and just yelled at everybody for being privileged and making life harder for the detainees. And nobody really was confident enough or knew how to respond to that. And so people just immediately decamped. And I'm not saying, you know, and I include myself in that. I didn't know how to argue against this person. Just in terms of my like political sensibilities, I would have wanted the camp to stay, but confronted with this person, I didn't know what to say. So I think moving forward, there needs to be this sort of conception of the balance of the autonomous action and the more official, how the official political class and their connections with the NGOs, how they handle these situations, and they certainly have a role to play. I mean, these people who are having hearings need advocates to tell them, you know, this is what ICE is doing this week. This is what you have to look out for. Don't fall for this trick, this kind of thing, because it's very hard for activists to get that information and share it well. But then at the same time, we saw from LA that there needed to be more or less an uprising against these invasion-style tactics. And since then, as of now, that has slowed down ICE's momentum. They are trying to detain 3,000 people a day, and that was starting to rise when that uprising happened, and it's totally sunk since then. And so I think, you know, it's a combination of reasons why that happened. But I think militants have a role to play, but it has to be, you know, it has to be tactical. It has to be thought out about, you know, what are we really doing? What can go wrong? Or what if it means if we win, you know? And so you're in Chicago and you're, you know, we're very fortunate in New York that we haven't seen the kind of invasion that happened in LA. Trump is talking about doing in Chicago now. They seem to be wavering on it. In New York, I kind of imagine this is going to happen this winter after Mamdani becomes mayor. But what have you seen so far in Chicago? How do you see this stuff playing out?
Yeah, I mean, in Chicago, there was like the beginning of the year, ICE came with like Dr. Phil and they did this like very public raid on the news and like everyone was talking about it. And then it kind of like slowed down after that. People were like ready to like act. And there was like a lot of energy, but nothing like big had happened up until like June 4th when one of these nonprofits reported on one of their members being detained and at this center, at the ISAP center. And there was like 9 other people as well. It was like 10 total. Anyway, people, like the city, it was like the first major event to happen in Chicago and people like mobilized there immediately. And I think that really brought out like, you know, that was a moment where the like more militant and autonomous and the nonprofit met each other and first like kind of clashed in the streets where the nonprofit was very much into this like spectacle of like having people there and making it seem like they were trying to stop this detention of folks, but they really were like collaborating with the CPD and with local like electeds to get their photo ops and to like, you know, people don't want to see their neighbors kidnapped. So that was a very like big moment for Chicago. And then after that, where there was like mobilizations at 55 Monroe, which is the immigration court.
Yeah, I think a really interesting thing to witness has been the kind of parallel tracks that the various, you know, named organizations on one hand and autonomous groups of you know, folks who know each other and are compelled to act have chosen over the past few months in Chicago. At the beginning of the kind of like mass mobilization this summer, it was very like kind of strategically confused. So on one hand, all of the big named organizations, like my comrade just said, mostly emphasized either just like marching around in circles or exclusively focused on specific locations when it benefited them and when they could use it for publicity. But as the summer progressed, folks started focusing more and more on specific sites of federal infrastructure in downtown Chicago, to such an extent that by the time that there was what I at least take to be the mass mobilization that everyone was waiting for in Chicago on June 10th, it split up into a series of snake marches, many of which went straight for those sites of federal infrastructure. And since then, that has been the sort of day-to-day emphasis of folks who aren't associated with the nonprofits, aren't associated with the trade unions or the city government, or the Democratic Party. And that's at least interesting to see. It's unclear, I think, to all of us how that's going to play out as things progress. But it definitely remains relevant, I think, as stuff coalesces around the detention center outside of the city.
And part of this, following the mobilization on June 10th, was the focus on the immigration court, so early on in the summer, it was very difficult for anyone to actually intervene to stop deportations because the strategy of federal agents was to do mostly very quick raids on people's homes where they'd knock on the door, and if people didn't respond in a few minutes, they'd leave. So the ability of a rapid response strategy to actually stop things was just not possible. And so with the immigration court, at a certain point in time, agents started showing up at the court, and the DHS attorney would move to dismiss and move for expedited removal. And then whether or not that was granted, these agents would be waiting by the door of the courtroom to kidnap people. And this was seen to be happening, and the court was not a focus of any organizing by the nonprofits or even really presence. So part of what came out of that was that people started blockading the garage, loading dock doors of the court, which was inside a building that was a private building with restaurant, condos, like all sorts of things were happening in the building that was not a federal building. And people also started accompanying people to court hearings and just basically being outside and blockading those loading docks every single day. And this did eventually lead to ICE abandoning the strategy of showing up to the court.
Yeah, I just want to underscore that it was really, really cool to see a sort of organic pressure campaign emerge around the court at 55 Monroe, a tactic that had just been like expedient to block ICE fans, ended up blocking the kind of like place where commerce and maintenance and et cetera would enter and exit the building. And because it was privately owned, that made it fairly easy for folks to just like pass around numbers for the leasing agency to show up every day and just like throw shit in front of the loading dock doors to like, I mean, yeah, just like to make things very, very difficult for building management, for the owners, et cetera, in such a kind of aggressive way at the very beginning that within about a week and a half, ICE had been denied access to the loading docks because the doors were getting all fucked up. They'd been denied access to the side door because it opened up straight onto the street, and they were forced to move their kidnappings elsewhere.
I think similar, like tying the like stuff that happened at 55 Monroe back to like the example you mentioned here with like the Occupy ICE stuff in New York. There was a moment where like the nonprofits were like not happy with people blockading 55 Monroe and were, you know, telling people in their circles like, this is a horrible tactic, like they're actually like preventing people from like having due process, and they were just like completely like, yeah, they didn't want people to take this action. And then people later found out that people's court dates were being moved to like 2029, which bought them four more years, which was actually a good thing, where people could, you know, find a lawyer, raise money for that, etc. And I think that moment was also pretty important for people who are breaking out of that nonprofit world.
So we've been talking a lot about nonprofits in Chicago, and I just want to emphasize that there's plenty of nonprofits that do cool stuff. It's a legal status, right? It's not a political category. Like, chances are a lot of the listeners of this show, their employment is for a nonprofit. And it might be like helping people getting out of violent relationships find a home, things like that. There's plenty of nonprofits that do cool shit. And just because you have a 501c3 status doesn't mean that you're up to no good politically. So could you say a little bit about what we actually mean when we say the nonprofits in Chicago? And feel free to name them.
I'll just maybe start with like a quick, I think, crucial historical gloss in that, like, go back, if you go back to like the time of like the New Left to like 60s and 70s, you would have all these groups that were like righteous political actors, like Panthers, Young Lords, etc., who were like setting up these like survival programs and so on, like things like the free breakfasts, but also things like free clinics that were like not means tested. You know, they weren't like geographically like circumscribed. You know, anybody could have these things. And what actually ended up happening in Chicago, that I think, actually just don't know if it happened in other places or not, was just like a sustained kind of destruction and then like recreating of the same program by the city itself. So it'd be like these clinics are getting harassed by the CPD, basically to the point of closure. And then like immediately after, the city of Chicago steps in, like at this time it was the Daley administration, like steps in and actually makes that social service just like in a means tested, like not radical way anymore. And I think from that point forwards, what we've seen is the construction of a political machine in Chicago that includes groups that are nominally civil society organizations, but which are basically hand in glove with social service provisioning inside of the city. And I think that that has extended into the current day, in that there are plenty of like large, like supposedly political organizations that are mostly hand in glove with the city government itself. Like I'm thinking particularly of CARPER is one of them, Chicago Alliance Against Racial and Police Oppression, which is on the board for one of the, like the chair of that group is on the board for one of the city's initiatives for like community policing. And I think if you asked some people of that, that would be like proof that we're like embedded in this, so that like we can make our reforms and so on, and we can actually get that way. But I think that it actually just puts an emphasis on like keeping the peace and like law and order. So I don't know if other people want.
Yeah, just to name and shame as relevant to fighting deportations, the main organizations with nonprofit status who do the thing that we call nonprofit stuff are the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights, ICER, and a group called Organized Communities Against Deportations, or OCAD. These are both the organizations primarily that have pushed what I think it would be easy to refer to as pro-deportations tactical lines at critical junctures in the fight against ICE, and just in general.
Can you say what you mean by that?
I've been asked to explain the pro-deportations line. Yeah, sure. The one example of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights intervening in an ongoing detention to stop it, or to appear to stop it, to give the symbolic appearance of fighting deportations, occurred because one of their own members was a victim of it and realized that it would be a great opportunity to get it in the news. And so when everybody showed up and started, you know, appealing to the crowd to block an ICE van, local members of ICER jumped up in front of them, mortified, and screamed, "No, please don't do that. That's not allowed. You're not allowed to do that." At every other instance where people have expressed intent to block a deportation, these groups, which actually manage and silo off all of the information about rapid response in the city, have protested against that vociferously. I think that this creates an odd arrangement among local rapid response networks, which are managed by this group OCAD, where kind of local rank and file who manage them and who run them and who do the rapid response work have received a kind of marching order from the local authority, or what's taken to be the local authority, which is OCAD, that their role is to provide effectively legal support after a deportation has occurred. And that has resulted in a sort of uniform tactical line among nonprofits in the city that is, as they put it, anti-intervention, or as I think we could very easily put it, pro-deportations.
Hot take.
I think just to be very brief on this, I think that this situation actually puts us as anarchists in a kind of prime position insofar as the MO of these groups is functionally keeping the peace, that it actually puts us in a situation where almost any strategic coordinated direct action amounts to an outflanking. So in particular, the activities like at Monroe were just like an untouchable item for these groups because it's bad for business and it's bad for the city of Chicago. And it gives autonomous actors leeway to like actually affect those changes and put those politics into action. I think one of my comrades has some more to say on it, maybe.
Yeah, I think a part of this too is that people had to build these like autonomous networks and build the ability to do things away from the nonprofits, because the nonprofits, which as my comrade mentioned, manage the rapid response network and get the hotline calls of reports of ICE sightings, are not sharing that information even when it is a situation where people could respond as they did at that ISAP center when when somebody who was part of that organization had been detained. The court, again, being this key example where they were aware that people were being kidnapped there. It was a clear location where people could intervene because ICE were there all day. And yet there was no reporting back or sharing even of the fact that people were being detained there. And the same thing goes for the Broadview Processing Center, where there is also this situation where they were like not sharing the information out about people getting detained. Yeah,
and to bring things up to the more kind of present day, over the past couple weeks, there have been protests at the Broadview Processing Center, which is just outside of Chicago in Broadview, Illinois. And that is a place where people detained, not just in Chicago, not just in Illinois, but states around the region, and it's called the Chicago Area of Responsibility for ICE, are taken there for processing before they are sent to detention camps in other states or to airports like the Gary Airport in Gary, Indiana, where they're generally flown not out of the country normally, but to other states where they are often then flown out of the country or to different detention camps. But there have been several protests there on Fridays, which is when people are normally bussed out by ICE. And also much more recently on Friday, I'm sure people have seen in the news, but ICE killed someone in Chicago. This man, Silverio Villegas Gonzalez. And I think that is definitely, I mean, ICE has killed a couple people in the States over the past couple weeks, months.
Not to mention the people that are dying in detention.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, of
but
course.
This, I think, you know, we've all had a busy weekend. We've been at the Anarchist Book Fair. We've been, you know, there's panels and readings and stuff, but I haven't seen the video yet, but it sounds like they just killed this man in cold blood for no reason. Yeah. Or maybe he was trying to escape.
As he was trying to get away.
Yeah, but that's not a reason to kill someone. And the video of it, I think, is gonna escalate the resistance against ICE, to say the least.
And it points to a common fallacy promoted by cops everywhere, including the federal cops, this idea that they were in like some kind of imminent danger and they had no choice but to take action. So the ICE cops said, oh, he was driving a vehicle toward me. And it really highlights that there's so many cases in recent history when that excuse has been used, and it was just somebody trying to start a car or drive a car away from a cop, because it's like, you don't, chances are if you're facing detention, you want to get away. You don't want to just murder the cop and then take it from there, you know?
The initial story, I think, was that this guy actually pinned an ICE officer with the vehicle, and the ICE officer was dragged and injured, and it was just totally fabricated. Maybe they asked AI what would be a good story or something.
You know, in the criminal justice field, we've developed a fail-safe method for identifying when a cop is lying. Do you know what it is? Their mouth is moving.
I think this also, the immediate ICE narrative that came out really speaks to the way ICE and police in general create this like idea that anyone who they kill and anyone who they harm is guilty. And that this also is particularly something that we need to be aware of, because in the context of anti-deportation, there has been this like longstanding tendency to frame everything in terms of innocence and to emphasize like certain people's lives is more valuable than other people's lives. So, for example, like saying if it's a family or if people, you know, have a claim for asylum, or if if they work a job, as my comrade said, they are somehow more worthy of life or more worthy of being in this country than someone else is. And there was stuff going around about this too, like early on with the, like, you should have your papers on hand, as if like the expectation is what we care about is the people who have their papers on hand and not who can have their papers on hand, who have papers. All of this leads to this idea that anytime something horrible like this happens, we are thrown into this evaluation of whether a person is worthy to be alive. And this is a calculus that the police create that we buy into. And then we speaking of really both left and then also speaking of other people, and like the liberals do this frequently, but of trying to prove someone's innocence. And it is impossible to prove innocence along the logics of the state and of the police, because their logics of innocence is based in white supremacy. And there is no way to prove a person innocent when they are defined as guilty by being black or brown.
Thank you for all those reflections and updates on what's going on in Chicago. I think obviously this is going to get a lot more intense over the months and years to come. And we've already seen how important grassroots mobilization, militant mobilization can be to slow this down and to make it really hard for them to, you know, seamlessly enact this agenda of mass deportations, which are initially coming for immigrant workers and will absolutely come for us whenever it can. So this is, you know, this is, I think, our duty now as leftists, as militants.
Yeah, could I hop on that for a minute and just make a point that might be obvious, which is these large nonprofit organizations that we've been talking about, their messaging is consistently like, we are the experts, follow us, do what we say. And I think that that's, in ordinary times, it's offensive. In our time, it's incredibly dangerous. As we've seen from all over the country, it's not going to be one organization or one strategy that slows this thing down and ultimately defeats it. It's going to be all kinds of people all over the place taking independent action. It's actually very difficult, borderline impossible, for a large citywide or even neighborhood-wide organization to stop a deportation. In practice, where that has been successful, it has almost always fallen to just neighbors who witness a deportation and put themselves between the person being kidnapped and the pigs trying to kidnap them. And so when these organizations come out and say, no, just wait for us. No, that's fine. Well, no, when you show up in a country that you've never been before, we'll write a writ, you know. It's a horrible message to send. And if everybody listened to them, nothing would happen. So people should really just do whatever their conscience permits right now, and stopping this thing in the million different places that it can be, you know, slowed down, sabotaged, otherwise impeded. And don't let anybody tell you that what you're doing is wrong or that you're not qualified to do it.
So, yeah. Thanks for that, Jared. I think, you know, even when there are these stories of just neighbors or, you know, folks at a school or folks at a workplace who stop ICE in some way, and it's not organized and it's not, you know, people who have like, a firm ideological line or something, we still have a role in making sure those stories get out when we hear about them, to let people know what's working. And so I want to maybe close this episode out talking a little bit about how people can get organized to do this work, whether it be simply reporting or simply compiling stories and spreading them, or organizing to do something more interventionist. And you've got a couple pieces about this. One is some reflections on the Bring the Ruckus organization, and another one is just called Getting Organized. And so maybe we can talk a little bit to the listeners out there who are, you know, feeling hopeless right now or not knowing what to do. How did your group get together? What are some of the points of these texts? And what's worked for you?
So we were a minority faction within the Zizian organization. Have you? and when Ziz actually deviated from the invariant program and began to embrace legality, we decided that we needed to honor the true illegalist spirit of this. Okay, does someone want to answer for real?
I was wondering why you guys are all vegans.
Yeah, we Comrade Candle, please join the Lake Effect.
Yeah, I mean, I think like we've talked about a little bit before, we kind of came together as like a writing project, writing this report back on the Palestine encampment at UChicago. And I think over the group has kind of like changed a bit, like people have joined in. And I think honestly, a lot of it sort of came together in the sense of we were writing this thing and we were like, oh, it's really long. We might need to have our own website for it. And let's have like a name. And then we made a website and then we put that piece up. And then I think there were kind of just like various like gaps in time where we were kind of like, oh, what are we doing? Like we have a website. But we did eventually just like sit down, and I think it was Jared who was kind of like, all right, guys, like, what are we doing? Shit or get off the pot.
Is this a situationship or what?
Yeah. And so we did just have to get together and be like, all right, well, we want to, you know, think about what we can do in our city. We want to continue writing together. Like, what are different kind of structures we can use that allow people, or, you know, encourage people's like independent freedom to, you know, kind of like do the things that they find important, but also have like a place where we can come back together and think and write.
Yeah, I guess to like answer the question, there's like a lot of book clubs out there and a lot of like crews of people who love doing shit together. And I think something that like sets us apart is that we think together and we work together. And I guess that's the main thing in getting organized and what people should be doing right now, like reading about the stuff that's going on in LA or in Texas or in Portland or New York, Chicago, wherever. Not trying to like necessarily like reinvent the wheel or like, yeah, like read stuff. But also like put that into practice or like get creative and get inspired and do something with the stuff you're engaging with, whether that's like report backs or like news or like Instagram stories, whatever the heck people choose to engage with.
I just say like it involves paying attention to what's going on in the world. And that doesn't just mean like doom scrolling on the news or something like that, but like pay attention, look for social fault lines, like where you think that things might be going because of current events and because of history. You know, we can't read tea leaves, but we are all smart enough to make educated guesses. And get together with people and just start doing shit. I think we spent a long time like looking for the group that agreed with us and was already acting. And what we ended up figuring out, I think the hard way, was just that that didn't exist and that that was us if we so chose. So pay attention, meet up with some people, and then just start acting. And it sounds kind of trite, but honestly, you know, no one way is going to work.
Yeah, do it yourself. I think that obviously I agree with everything everyone said because I'm in this group. But something that I really value about the way that we work together, I think, springs from the fact that we trust one another to step in when we need it. We started by working together practically, and we came together because we all valued that work and we wanted it to be more effective and we wanted it to be more incisive. And so we started reading and thinking and writing together. So if you're going to get together with your homies and do stuff, please also write about it and put it somewhere. So these ideas can be hashed out and so we can figure out where we're wrong and where we're right and what's working and what's not working.
Don't really have much to add to that, but I think it's very important to have the ability to take a step back and think strategically. And I think that's what the addition of the thinking and writing component really allows versus the solely acting. And conversely, I think it is also dangerous to just be thinking, because then you get separated from the actual practical activity and the testing of whether the things you're thinking about actually work in reality. And so I think that an important part of figuring something out is like find people you can act with, find people you can think with, and then also take the time to reflect on what you're doing.
I would like to jump on that and say that collective writing is an incredibly important political tool, and writing too often falls to like a small number of people who are treated like some kind of sages, and so sometimes they step into that role a little too eagerly. But, you know, as our friend Beth Henson says, writing is a form of thinking. And if you've ever had the experience of writing even a short text, you probably went into it with the notion that you knew exactly what you were going to say and you understood the topic very well. And as soon as you started putting things on the page, you realized that you actually had a lot of thinking to do and you needed to be more systematic and you needed to rely on knowledge that you didn't have and the expertise of those around you. And so the earliest meetings that we had before we were even a group were these long meetings where we just rehashed every fucking detail of the UChicago encampment. And we tried to put it together in as systematic a way as possible. And we ended up writing a little book, you know, and I understand there's a kind of anti-intellectual tendency within leftism where usually people from middle-class backgrounds who like feel guilty about that are like, oh, you're just an academic. Oh, you're just a, you know, armchair, whatever. And it's certainly possible to be that way. But in our case, actually sitting down and working through this experience helped us develop a common political vocabulary, a common sensibility, a common set of kind of tactical sensibilities and strategic sensibilities that has enabled us to work together very cohesively in the past year or so. Whereas I think that if we had begun, as these kinds of projects often begin, with like, oh, let's hammer out some completely abstract principles of unity and that have nothing to do with actually our material lives, and you can just end up in these scholastic arguments until the end of time, and then when an actual struggle kicks off, you go into it and you realize that nobody actually meant the things the same way, and you have suddenly everybody's doing something different, and they all think the other one's wrong, right? And so I feel like just writing together, thinking together, and the final thing that I'll say to all my white boys out there, you know, I'm old white cis guy, possibly the oldest, whitest, and most cis in the group, possibly ever. I feel like in the little corner of the left that probably listens to the Antifada. That is too common a profile for the average person who writes this stuff. And I feel like if you have these skills, it's not a gift that you got from heaven. Somebody taught you how to do it. And you should really socialize these skills, help people who do not fit your description, build up the confidence to write on their own. And I feel like it'll be a massive W if we can spread around who is writing, what they're writing about, what experiences are being represented. And it's really easy to do.
Just to echo that, and maybe to turn a little more towards like how we work with one another, a concept that I thought was actually really fun to hash out with other Lake Effectors in the Getting Organized piece was discipline, which is, I think, kind of thorny and scary sounding to lots of people for good reason, great reason even, but which we all kind of believed that we also exhibited in our own weird way. And what we ended up settling on was a distinction between disciplining oneself to an external authority. So maybe abstract points of unity that are hammered out by the talking heads of the group at the very beginning versus the sort of obligation that we all feel to one another and to the collective project of the group, even as it changes over time, which we called internal discipline. And at least personally, myself as a private individual, that has been one of the more personally transformative and inspiring things that I've experienced while working with all of y'all.
That's right, folks. Discipline can be hot. All right.
Yeah, I guess I know I don't think of it so much as discipline as like responsibility to each other. You know what I mean? Like responsibility to yourself, responsibility to people who you make commitments to as well.
All right. I got one last thing to ask Jared about. We have to mention that, believe it or not, you've released a new book. And that's a major reason why you folks are in town is Jared did a panel at the Anarchist Book Fair yesterday, and then we did a reading afterwards at Book Row in Brooklyn. And we're going to release another episode with some audio from that reading. But while we got you here, tell us a little bit about this book.
Thanks, Andy. This book is a pet project of mine. It collects 10 years of essays, all of which had been previously published elsewhere, the majority of which were published in Hard Crackers on its website, which means that none of you have ever read it. I'm just kidding.
We have actually a lot of listeners love Hard Crackers.
Okay, well, I take it back then. You know, one time Lauren Goldner was asking us, you know, why don't more people read Insurgent Notes? And I said, well, how many people read it? And he's like, 200 people per week. And I said, well, what's your intended audience? And he said, the left communists. And I said, you got them all. You got full saturation. Anyway, so this book collects 10 years of essays, beginning chronologically in 2014, that's when the first essay appears, but also thematically it begins with Occupy Wall Street, which I reflect on a lot in some of the essays. And it represents five different areas of my own kind of preoccupations over the years. There's a section on the kind of early street movements that became Black Lives Matter. There's a section on the culture stuff, like horror movies, punk, like the kind of like C.L.R. James approach that I brought to analyzing all the cultural goods that I love. There's some stuff on Rikers Island that's a bit like the demos for the Captives book. If you like that, you'll like these. There's a section of my writing on the far right, which was like the infiltrating the alt-right story, which I came on this podcast about 7 years ago and we had a funny disguise my voice when I was...
The truth has been revealed. That was Jared.
Yeah, it was me. That was so frustrating because that article got shared by like a bajillion people. Like the Mountain Goats dude shared it. He was just like, this is a good essay. I read it every day. What can I say? No, the Mountain Goats dude shared it and like all these cool people and people, quite frankly, who I wouldn't mind hanging out with. They were like, oh, this is brilliant. And it was fucking a pseudonym. And then the Nazis figured out that it was me, and they put it on their like Nazi websites. And so I'm like, fuck, now all the Nazis know that I wrote it. And none of the fucking people, none of our side. Anyway.
You could have been rocking out with John Darnielle right now.
I know. It would have changed my life. So, read my new book. I wrote it by hand. As I say in Leviticus, you wouldn't understand. where were we? And then a couple of essays, like I go to different Trump rallies and try to make sense of what the hell's going on. And I kind of wind up more confused than I was in the first place. And then the centerpiece of the book, which gives it its title, is called Every Fire Needs a Little Bit of Help. It was a part of the EndNotes 2022 special issue commemorating the second anniversary of the George Floyd Rebellion, which, of course, was a smash hit upon its release. And so I was able to put it into a book, and I'm very appreciative, actually, for EndNotes for editing that, and for the comrades at Hardcrackers who edited a lot of the stuff. And it's just awesome to be here in New York, to be here with Andy. I've been working with Andy for a long time on all kinds of projects. Some of them were actually even good. we did a reading last night that was just, it was really special for me to have like the Chicago comrades here doing the shit that I was doing when I was their age, you know? It was like some grimy little reading and like an alley, and there was a winged cockroach that kept landing on my head, and people were pointing at me and screaming, and I was like, what? You know? Yeah, this is, come on. And he goes, I'm walking here. No. Yeah,
having a reading in a place called the Punk Alley, it sounded really cool when I had the idea for it. And then in practice, it was a little grimier.
No way. It was fucking perfect. It was just so perfect. No, and so, like, this has just been such a cool experience. We had a great panel at the Anarchist Book Fair. If you like my stuff, if you've heard me on the show before and can stand it, I think this book's actually a cool place to start, because it's got a little sampler pack. Get a, like, little sample of what's in the other four books. If you like what you hear, you know, shoot me an email. I'm not on social media or anything like that, but I'd love to hear from you.
A couple details to add about this book. There's essays in there, not just on your political experiences and reflections, but also some essays about popular culture, like Hellraiser, The Walking Dead, The Misfits, and also there's an introduction by me.
By Andy.
So if, you know, if you're a Antifada completist, and if you're a Fandy, you got to get this book. And so you can order it from, don't laugh, there's Fandies. There's some Fandies out there. you can get this book from PM Press, or you can get it from us at the Antifada. And let me tell you how to do that. If you are a subscriber on the Patreon, you can upgrade your subscription to the annual $10 level. You pay for the whole year up front. You get a 17% discount. And when you do that, you can DM me your mailing address. And as long as you're in the continental United States, I will send it to you postage paid. If you're not in the continental United States, we will figure something else out. And if you are not subscribed yet, you can do the same thing. Sign up at the $10 level for the annual subscription, and you're going to get this book. I'm going to mail it to you. I'm going to mail you a little something special along with it. So that's patreon.com/theantifada to get the book, or PM Press. You don't have to.
Wait, you make money off this show?
Yeah, it's my job.
Man, I've been on this show like 50 fucking times. What the fuck?
How was that Chinese food?
Oh, it was delicious, actually. Okay, Andy got us all vegan Chinese food. I'm just kidding. Please support all the Fandies out there. Please support the Antifada.
Thank you, Lake Effect. This was a real pleasure. Keep up the good work. Thanks for listening, everybody.